Hello, and welcome to Beat Cafe, a weekly program sponsored by Offbeat Magazine that explores the music scene in New Orleans and the broader reach of Louisiana. I'm David Johnson, editor at Offbeat and host of this show. Offbeat is a proud supporter of WHIV 102.3 FM. I encourage you to visit offbeat.com, where you can still read our digital edition of the Jazz Fest Bible, featuring stories about many of the acts that recently appeared at the revival of our city's biggest musical event, including Elvis Costello, Lily Lewis, Joy Clark, Mia Borders, Jamil Sharif, Johnny Sansone, and Ricky Lee Jones, just to name a few. You'll find these stories, plus our music listings, original photos and videos, daily news updates, and podcasts of past episodes of Beat Cafe at offbeat.com. On today's episode, I will be joined by two musicians who are paying tribute to legends from the past. Up first, I'll be joined by Evan Christopher, a jazz clarinetist whose latest album features the songs of New Orleans great Sidney Bechet. Evan is now based in New York, but he'll discuss the lasting impact of his time spent in our city. In the second half of the program, we'll meet Catherine Hobgood Ray, a guitarist and vocalist who has spent years researching the life story of Snoozer Quinn, a fingerstyle jazz guitarist from Louisiana, whose career was cut short in 1949 by tuberculosis. Catherine has recently published a biography of Snoozer Quinn, which includes sheet music of his original compositions. These interviews are pre-recorded. Catherine and I made one mistake that I should clear up here. I introduce a song Snoozer recorded with Johnny Wiggs that I introduce as Out of Nowhere. That title is incorrect. The title of the song is actually Nobody's Sweetheart. I apologize for the mistake, but nonetheless, you're going to hear great music that deserves revived publicity. So I am so pleased today to be joined by Evan Christopher, a clarinet player, obviously, who has recorded the Clarinet Road series, just one of many projects he has had underway over the years. So welcome to Beat Cafe, Evan. Happy to have you here.
Thank you, David. Great to see you.
So, Evan, let's talk about your newest recording. It is a French release off Camille Productions. It's called Blues in the Air. It was just released in March. Tell us about what we can find on this album and where we can find it.
You know, in the United States, you can find it at Louisiana Music Factory, or if you want to download it on Bandcamp and from Camille Productions website. This is my second project with them. The first one was a quartet CD with a guitarist, Fappy Lafortin, who's deeply entrenched in the Django Reinhardt, minouche or gypsy jazz style. They invited me to do a follow-up project the next year dedicated to the music of Sidney Bechet. So we focused on Sidney's compositional prowess and his ability to be rich with not only the blues, but with the kind of the harmonic language of the European classical music that he loves so much. So it kind of focuses more on his compositions than, say, just his playing style, which when most people try to do something for Sidney Bechet, they're, for better or worse, they're usually trying to copy his style. I think this is nice that we get to look at his compositions and try not to change too much. So we're not trying to really focus on the salient features of what his vision was.
Of course, Sidney Bechet, native of New Orleans, considered one of the world's greatest clarinet players, has been a strong influence on you. When did you become familiar with Sidney Bechet's work?
Gosh, you know, pretty late. I was probably already in high school by the time I got to figuring out what Bechet was about in the early days of CD recordings. And I think it was his, RCA released a 3-CD set of his Victor recordings. And that was my start. That was before I even moved to New Orleans. So when I moved to New Orleans in 1994, that was really the first opportunity I had to kind of walk in Sidney's footsteps, as it were.
So, you know, you say late high school, that's just an indicator. There's obviously you picked up the clarinet very early in life. When did you first start playing the clarinet?
Well, we're given the opportunity to pick up an instrument usually in middle school where I grew up in California. That was kind of where I started. I was about 11 years old and in the junior high school band. And my interests, went pretty quickly to swing and jazz styles. And so before Sidney Bechet, I discovered Johnny Dodds with Louis Armstrong's Hot Fives and Sevens, and discovered Artie Shaw, thanks to my father and some of his record collections. And that was sort of a start. And then the Ellington's clarinet players were always fascinating. But it took a while before I really made the connection to these clarinet players and the city of New Orleans. You know, everybody has to be from somewhere, but the significance of New Orleans isn't something that I was really able to appreciate kind of until I moved there in 1994.
And what brought you to New Orleans that year?
I had been there on a tour with a singer-songwriter the summer before. I think it was maybe June of 1994. We played Tipitina's. It was a singer-songwriter from California, A.J. Croce, and Jim Croce's son. Yes. And we were promoting his first release on private records and going all over the place. But we hustled from Chicago to New Orleans and some... I don't even want to know how fast they must have been going to have gotten us there as fast as they did. We played a matinee at Cubby Bear in Chicago and woke up in New Orleans looking for the hotel on St. Charles Avenue. And it was, I don't know if you remember the Warner Brothers cartoon of Porky and Wacky Land.
I don't recall.
Porky and Wacky Land, Porky Pig's in Search of the Dodo. And everything is really surreal. There's a lot of surrealist imagery and stuff like that. And there's for some reason, when I looked out the bus window when I woke up, just everything was crooked.
New Orleans has that kind of that look, especially just kind of that's kind of lean. Kind of
oddly, yeah, everything was just and it and the air was thicker and heavier than anything. You say you just had a really hot jazz fest season. Well, this was mid June, maybe even late June. And sure, we'd been to Memphis and we'd been to other places on that tour. Sometimes even opening for like the Neville Brothers and things like that. And and I'll just say even then, none of the mystique and the history of New Orleans music, I'd never really. I'd never really made the regionality of it something that I a consideration, so I was fascinated by the city when we got there. I was fascinated by how many young cats there were interested in not only traditional New Orleans music but also early jazz, that would just seem like the way to do it. There was a clarinet player named Tim Lachlan who needed a substitute for his job on the Natchez Steamboat in the evenings. So I did that for him for a few weeks. And that was enough time to meet a ton of other musicians and a ton of people. That was fall of 94, October, November. Pretty much by then it was, I was getting calls to basically play for carnival season of 90-95. So there was just plenty of work instantly, it seemed like, as long as you could play your horn and as long as you knew a lot of tunes.
Well, I know you took a really deep dive into studying the clarinet in New Orleans that became a part of your academic studies. I'm curious if you could tell me more about that and what you discovered in your research. You really researched, not just played clarinet in New Orleans.
You know, David, it's a shame that it had to be so academic or it didn't have to be necessarily, but to feel like I was really doing it correctly. And once I actually figured out the distinction between New Orleans music and New Orleans traditional music and early jazz, meaning, sure, Louis Armstrong, Sidney Bechet, King Oliver, even the other bands like the original Dixieland Jazz Band, they are New Orleans musicians, but they're not really playing the music as they played it in New Orleans, are they? So, the early records that they're able to make in the 20s and for a few of the bands in the late teens, it doesn't you know, even though I was interested in that music, there was nobody in New Orleans playing those tunes, really, because it wasn't, that was a whole nother thing. So it became academic because there were no clarinet players left to learn from. Willie Humphreys was the last of those Creole clarinet players. He passed away a few months before I arrived into town. It ended up being a lot of trips to the Tulane Jazz Archives, where they had the wonderful oral history collections, that many of them which are digitized on the Music Rising, you know, Tulane's Music Rising project. But back then we had to go to the Tulane Jazz Archive, and Dr. Bruce Rayburn would get you set up with the reel-to-reel tapes and play them for you. And, you could get your little handy tape recorder and tape them or take notes furiously. But that was pretty much what we had to do for me to take lessons from ghosts, to hear what these clarinet players were doing and how they were doing it. The interviewers didn't follow standard interview guidelines necessarily. So, you know, it's a little, you'd have to take everything. You kind of have to sift through it. But, there was interviews with Alphonse Pacou and his bar on Ursuline, and, you know, interviews with Albert Burbank and George Lewis and, you know, all the Louis Cottrell, all the wonderful Creole clarinet players that were lesser known, that stayed in New Orleans longer and didn't disappear up to Chicago, New York, like Omer Simeon with Jell Earl Morton and Barney Bigard with Duke Ellington and Albert Nicholas. And then getting to meet musicians in town and connect the dots and talk about the neighborhoods and figure out where these places are. And then finally start to see, just being a working musician in New Orleans, where the connections were. So it was both. It was the proper, I want to think it was the proper blend of street and school to kind of piece it together.
Well, that's remarkable, because a lot of musicians would not go to that degree. Like you said, to learn from ghosts, that says a lot about a respect for everything that preceded you. Would you say there's now a greater appreciation for that era of jazz compared to when you first came here?
By whom and where?
Well, let's say, there's been a kind of a trad jazz revival to some degree, although you do describe your work, I know, as a quote, as contemporary early jazz.
And I think somebody else made that up, but I liked it. Somebody else made that up and I kind of liked it. It was partially philosophical and partly business to really try to distinguish what I was doing as an ethnic clarinet style, like you would think of the way clarinet is played in Macedonia or Turkey or the French West Indies or klezmer. I was really trying to get away from the idea that seems to kind of pervade the people's imaginations about New Orleans music being a type of jazz, when it's really the other way around. So I wanted to make it really clear that what I was doing was exploring traditional New Orleans music and trying to see if there were, what the possibilities were for the language in that tradition, instead of evolving past the tradition and doing something more, actually just trying to use the stylistic elements and make something that was, for lack of a better word, contemporary.
So you compose music, obviously. Do you, how, what is the composition practice like for you? Where do you draw your inspiration?
That was a new thing. That was people, I guess all improvising musicians, especially in this style, are composers in a way, right? All these great New Orleans musicians were composers, because they basically, even if it wasn't their song, they came up with their own way of playing it. They're composing. And then when the improvised solo became part of the, became important to the style, and we, a lot of people credit Sidney Bechet with that, well, then they're composing too. There's a structure that they're following, but they're, and I think it was even Wayne Shorter that said improvisation is composition sped up, and vice versa. Composition is improvisation slowed down. But that started really, after I came back, when the federal levies failed and I split town for a little bit. When I came back, I started composing more, and I was given opportunities to do it. The first time was a commission from Minneapolis, their arts organization. I'm sorry, Minnesota's orchestra had a commissioning project for their Pops series. And that was the first time that I got to do something. And then later, 2018, I was awarded something from a commissioning grant from Chamber Music America to do something with a small group. And then my album projects, I started focusing from about 2009 on. I started including as many songs of my own as other songs. It was a slow process. And then it was really late. It's more recent that I started having the audacity to put my songs in front of other musicians to play them.
Well, you have to earn your chops first, I guess. And
there's a lot of great tunes out there and a lot of great composers that you want people to know about. So, you know, you can easily spend a lifetime not doing any of your own music and having a fun time. So
indeed, we're going to take a brief break, a pause for the cause, and I will be back with Evan Christopher to discuss more about jazz clarinet.
The vibe of the city for human rights and social justice, WHIV 102.3 FM.
And we're back. I'm David Johnson, host of Beat Cafe, and I am joined today by Evan Christopher, jazz clarinetist. And Evan, you have lived in and out of New Orleans. You are currently in New York. I'm curious to know about what distinguishes kind of the music scene in New Orleans compared to other cities that you've worked in.
The biggest difference between the music scene in New Orleans and anywhere else I can think of is that the music is just integral to daily life in town. So whether it's the kids in the marching bands, whether it's the churches, and whether it's the overdependence on tourism, either way, music is just omnipresent. And several of the oldest traditions in the city are ongoing and continue to use the local vernacular soundscape. And that I can't say that about anywhere else I've ever been. Because I have not been to Cuba yet. I haven't been to very many places in Africa. There's a ton of places I haven't been. But in terms of an urban, you know, even as small as New Orleans is, as a city, that's the difference that, anywhere else you basically had to kind of, you know, jump up and down and wave your arms and say, hey, music's over here. But not New Orleans.
Yeah, no, it is. It's, as I think Ellis Marcellus said, in other places, culture comes down from on high. And in New Orleans, it just bubbles up from the streets. And yes, New Orleans has a soundtrack no matter where you go. It seems that you're always hearing music somewhere. You know, Sidney Bechet obviously spent a lot of time in Paris, and you have as well. I know you were there, as you mentioned, after Hurricane Katrina wreaked havoc across so much of New Orleans. Tell me about the jazz scene in Paris and what does that do for a musician?
I confess, I don't know that much about the jazz scene in Paris. Found myself there when a nonprofit called French American Cultural Exchange, in collaboration with the cultural office of Paris, invited several New Orleans musicians to hang out for varying lengths of time, basically residencies. A handful of us were in Paris for a few weeks, and I just sort of dragged my feet and stayed as long as I could. So from pretty much the beginning of 2006 until maybe through the spring of 2007, and even after that, I was kind of in and out. I didn't really come back officially to New Orleans till kind of 2008. I was hanging out, and I had a little group, and we were doing some things. I don't feel like I was ever actually living there, and I don't feel like I was actually on the scene, working with many of the French musicians. I kind of had my own little band, and we would do stuff. I don't remember feeling like there was an abundance of places to do things, but in to be honest, I don't feel like there are abundance of places for me to do things in New Orleans. So, and if you ask me what the scene in New Orleans is like, I probably confess the same, that I don't really know what's going on. I have a handful of people and a handful, you know, I have a short list of people I like to work with, and I have a very short list of places that I like to partner with in terms of presenters. And I think it's the same thing. I think once you kind of make up your mind that you're not going to give your music away, because you can't afford to, for one thing, then you all of a sudden realize that the number of places you can present are fewer than it seems.
With that said, what more do you think could be done to nurture New Orleans musicians? Because you're not the first to say this. I mean, there are many people who have said that here we are, the birthplace of jazz, and yet we don't seem to be doing enough to really nurture that scene or those musicians. And
I think it's really pretty simple. Venues just need to the courage to charge for their music. It's that simple.
Mm-hmm. It's so that simple. Too much of a giveaway.
If they, you know, that's fine if the music is really only a drawing card to sell alcohol or to sell hotel rooms or to, you know, to ghost tours, I don't know, whatever. I don't know, but you know, and they can wait around to, they can be as legit as they want through the permitting process and all that nonsense. But look, the only reason that City Hall gets in the way is because there's so few presenters that are actually trying to monetize their music by charging for it. Meaning that if everybody was just doing that, so what is everybody? Everybody was playing outside. Well, the city just had to throw up their arms and say, oh, well, I guess we'll just have to let that go on for a while. It's kind of the same thing. If everybody just said, well, sorry, if everybody just did what Snug Harbor does and said, well, sorry, I don't care what you call us or what you designate us for or what you zone us as, we're going to charge, you know, for the music. And if everybody just started doing that, they would figure out a way, they'd get on board. They'd figure out a way to get their cut. They'd figure out a way to make it work. And I think that's really the simplest thing. You know, the musicians would then be responsible for actually raising the quality of what they do, for starters, to distinguish themselves, to be worthy of the music charge is, and the venues would have a responsibility to distinguish themselves from one another, like they did when I first got there. You know, when I first got there in the mid 90s, we were the ones that started Frenchman Street. Mm-hmm. You know, we were that generation of musicians that were doing our gigs in the early evening or whatever, and then doing our creative projects on Frenchman Street. So I was very happy being a sideman with groups like Neslort and Galactic and the Nightcrawlers and, you know, whatever. I didn't being able to hear those early bands, trying to get things like Klezmer All-Stars or Mas Mamones or even Royal Finger Bowl. I mean, every kind of music imaginable. And that's what we were doing. There was nothing going on Frenchman Street. So we're just doing our creative thing.
There was an amazing creative energy there in that time. I think it could really be documented as its own renaissance in a way. It was a remarkable thing for those of us who can remember it. Can you tell me about other influences, or you mentioned Django Reinhardt earlier, who have played an influence in your music?
Well, you know, Django was kind of an indirect thing. When I was over there, I'd started my own project. I love Django's work with clarinet players. He had a clarinetist that replaced the violinist Stefan Grappelli when the war broke out. And this clarinet player was named Hubert Rostang. And I love those recordings. And then I found a few sides that Django recorded with Barney Bigard when Duke Ellington's band came through town. Hugh Panassier set up a session, Django and Barney and Rex Stewart on trumpet. And I basically created a whole alternative alternative history to the music, and created this collaboration of blending New Orleans clarinet and New Orleans rhythms and other Creole rhythms with Django's music. So it wasn't, the focus was less Django and more just that, those two musical vocabularies. And Beshave has figured prominently. I mean, this new CD, Blues in the Air, is really the third recording project I've done with him in mind. Clarinet Road Volume 3, and then another for Arbor's Records in 2009 called The Remembering Song. And I just find myself coming back to his music and his story, because it's fascinating. You know, musically, in terms of personalities that captured my imagination as much. I mean, of course, Ellington, no question. And then after that, I think the people that I'm most infatuated with and idolize, I haven't really figured out a way to make that a part of my own music. So I think those are two big ones right there. Would be Ellington and Beshave.
So when you went about making this most recent album where you were selecting Beshave songs, how do you go about picking the ones that appeal to you the most?
Good question, David. Anytime I'm selecting songs for a project, there's been a lot more pressure I feel on artists that are doing things in, more concert formats and even festival programs. There's been a lot of pressure on us to kind of curate what we do in these neat little tidy packages, and tributes are always the easiest way to do it. But for Beshave, I wanted to start with things that were rich harmonically, and then things that hadn't been done much before, things that reflected his love of opera. We took one of his some themes from his ballet that nobody, not many people know about, and that music that nobody's playing. Tried to find things that nobody's ever recorded. So it was partially just not to be obscure, but try to find some real gems that are overlooked, and the things that are more well known. Just try to find a way to, like I say, bring out the most salient, interesting features of them. So it could be one of his themes that are as overplayed or mundane as Dans les Rues d'Antibes or Si tu vois ma mère, and try to come up with something that maintains as much of Beshave in it as you can, but politely moves it in a more personal direction.
Well, I'm very curious about Sidney Bechet's ballet. That is news to me. I was unaware. Just shows how little we often know about some of these great masters. One of your signatures is the Clarinet Road series. Tell me about how that project came to be, and describe that for us.
Clarinet Road, basically the same year that I found myself in New Orleans, we had also done a European tour, same singer-songwriter, and we ended up in Rome. This one venue we were at had a lot of different venues within it. We played sort of a kind of a larger disco room, I guess, for lack of a better description. And while we were sound checking, Tony Scott, the bebop clarinet player who'd expatriated to Rome, passed through all dressed in black, with a long flowing white beard, black beret, black cowboy boots. He was on his way to a little salon room where he was going to play some duo stuff, and his wife danced. Because I was playing clarinet at the sound check, I think that's what made him stop by, because you don't hear cats playing clarinet anymore. Now, for people who don't know, Tony Scott was basically, it was him and Buddy DeFranco all through the 50s dominating the polls and dominating the attention of critics on that instrument. And Tony was the more adventurous and the more ferocious of the two. And he had a wanderlust that caused him to, travel around and do a lot of different things. And his recordings for Verve, Polygram, things like music for Zen meditation, and, a lot of pretty out stuff, fun stuff. It's just a totally different approach to clarinet. So while we got to talking, and I went and found him in his room where he was playing. And at the end, he had these big blown up poster prints of him backstage at Carnegie Hall with Billie Holiday and Charlie Parker. And he used to autograph them for people. So he autographed one for me and he signed it to Evan Goodluck on Clarinet Road. And so that was, so I stole it from Tony's autograph. And so everything I did after that was Clarinet Road. It could be a CD, it could be a concert, it could be a band, it didn't matter. It could be publishing, and just everything became Clarinet Road.
Well, obviously the clarinet is taking you on many, many roads, to say the least.
Yeah, to say the least.
Is there a particular festival that you've played at that really stands out in your mind, one that you would really like to go back and do again, or that you have done repeatedly?
You know, I guess for festivals, once you take away all the stuff around them and you just focus on that 1 hour that you're on the stage, then I guess the one that really, when I say take away all the other stuff, I mean, you know, you're talking about festivals that it can take you as much as 2 days to get to them because they want you there a day early. Yeah, it'll take you a day to get home sometimes. You endure a lot for that 45 minutes on stage or whatever, how long it is. But I would say that Marciac, the festival in Marciac, France, still comes back to my mind as being one of the really kind of pure experiences that presents the music. It just, you know, the venue's vast and huge and it's enthusiastic and the sound is great. And, you know, the production, there's just seems to be a lot of respect for the cats. I've had the honor of being, you know, I was, when I did, what was it 2017? I did Newport. And I don't think there'd been another New Orleans style clarinetist headlining an act at Newport since George Lewis had been there, you know, 4 years before me. So, you know, there are a lot of things that seem like kind of a feather in your cap, and it seems like kind of a great honor, and it's fun. But in the experience, I think the one that still kind of made me go, wow, this is amazing what they've done. In terms of helping elevate the currency and elevate the art form, Marciac really sticks out to me. Montreux, I mean, that was a fun experience. But when you look at the program, it doesn't quite feel the same. It's even like Jazz and Heritage Fest. It doesn't, you know, there's only one venue at Jazz and Heritage Fest where I really enjoy listening to music, and that's the Lagniappe stage where the horses and jockeys get suited up in the paddock, you know.
Very eclectic mix there.
Exciting. Well, and it deserves it. It's one of the only stages that respects music that just can't really be put in a box, and where it's almost, you can almost do it acoustically. It sounds great. So, you know, at a certain point, I say you have to shed away all that other stuff and just be like, wow, this is amazing. But I'm sorry, that's one area where I can't walk away saying, you can't walk away from a festival going, wow, that was an amazing experience, except for how it sounded.
Well, it's an interesting perspective, because those of us who are not up on stage really don't have that insight into what a festival.
But you do. You must see it. You must see it when musicians like storm off the stage, or when they stop mid set, and you know, force the sound person to fix something, or. You know, whatever. I know you've seen it. You've seen it a million times. So there's, and you've definitely heard acts where you go, wow, well, sure was better, the other night at 4 a.m. at Rock and Bowl. You know, you do know.
Well, it is true that festivals do pose their own issues, but at the same time, it's that, I guess, that collective of music that really all summed up together just makes it such a unique experience. So maybe on the flip side of that, is there a particular venue you played at?
Well, that's what I dig. That's what I dig about the festival experience, is that part of it. I mean, that part of that instant community. Although, you know, it becomes difficult to say, because you know, that community becomes different than the real community, doesn't it? It's so it becomes its own thing. But that's the best thing about it. And I love Jazz Fest for that part of the experience of it. But you asked me about where it was most memorable to actually play.
Sure, of course. You've certainly seen many venues.
You know, the Snug Harbors of the world are the place where I feel most comfortable. Places that have always had their door open to you, like family, you know, and that's so the Snug Harbors of the world are the rooms that I dig the most. And they exist. They did exist all over the world. You know, they're disappearing slowly. But those are the feelings that you like, where, you know, just like, hey, yeah, come and do what you do. Good to see you again.
A reverence for music in those venues among staff, management, and audience and performer. I know what you're saying. Those are special places, shrines in many ways, to good music and to jazz. Before we wrap up, I know we're going to listen to one of your recordings, Valse Mayonnaise.
Sounds like mayonnaise.
Mayonnaise in New Orleans, of course, which of course is a reference to the Faubourg Marigny, as you told me earlier. And this is part of something you described as the Faubourg Variations Project, which also, I guess, was an offshoot of Live at Luthgen's. So we've thrown out a lot of
Faubourg here. The Live at Luthgen's. So basically, when Chamber Music America, we did the original Jazz Works grant, you could do anything you wanted, but I chose to make a sort of extended work that would be concert length. And the Faubourg Variations is a little play on words with Bach's The Goldberg Variations. And so there's one theme that gets kind of manipulated in different ways and snipped and cut and reharmonized. And so the waltz is really just one movement of that. I don't know what specific feeling it has to the Marigny, but for some reason that particular waltz ended up, and waltzes in general just seem to have a little bit of a sense of longing in them. So I think that's this is the only movement of the piece, of the whole Faubourg Variations, that seems to be speaking to a certain nostalgia for a different New Orleans.
So what are your plans for the summer?
This summer, taking it easy, David. This summer, I decided, here I'm saying, I love Marciac, but I actually said no this year. it was kind of out there on its own. They called kind of late. It wasn't really a way to parlay it into other things. So we're going to try to connect the dots better in 2023. So this summer, the family's just going to try to, make some visits to people we haven't seen since before the pandemic, and going to try to get the kids swimming lessons and things like that. You know, it's kind of a summer to settle in a little bit.
But surely that clarinet will be going on the road with you.
Yeah, I may do a few things. I joke about being semi-retired, but I really haven't done much. I'm saying that to you. I don't know when you're broadcasting this, but I mean, just this weekend, I have to go to Paris for two shows, and I will literally be on the ground less than 48 hours. I'm just going to make two hits and come right back. I'll pick my daughter up from school on Friday before I go to the airport, and I'll try to be back in time to pick her up after school on Monday. I mean, I'm really not doing that much. Doing a few streaming things with some of the musicians here in New Orleans. Doing a little teaching at Jazz at Lincoln Center. But pretty, you know,
it sounds like a good summer to me. But again, we're going to go close out by hearing Valse Mayonnaise, and thank you so much. The people of Paris, they're benefiting. They're the lucky ones in the days ahead, and we look forward to seeing you back here in New Orleans when you have the opportunity.
I hope to be back in New Orleans soon. It'll be great to see you guys again.
All right. Thanks again, Evan.
Thank you. Thank you.
We've got you covered, New Orleans. WHIV-FM and streaming 24/7 at WHIVFM.org. WHIVLP 102.3 FM, New Orleans.
So this is David Johnson. I am so pleased to be joined today by Catherine Hopgood Ray here on Beat Cafe. Catherine is an author. She is has just released a new book, Snoozer Quinn, Fingerstyle Jazz Guitar Pioneer, published by Out of the Past Music. And she's going to tell us all about Snoozer Quinn and his influence on jazz. And Catherine is also a musician herself, so she can fully appreciate the work that Snoozer did. So welcome, Catherine. So happy to have you here today.
Thanks, David. I'm so happy to be here. I'm so happy to talk about Snoozer.
That's great. So for those listeners who are unfamiliar with him, what a great nickname he had, though, a very unforgettable nickname. Tell us, who was Snoozer Quinn?
Snoozer Quinn, whose real name is Edward Quinn, was my great-great-uncle. And he, like me, was from Bogalusa, Louisiana. Born in 1907, actually in Macomb, but moved over to Bogalusa as a very young child, as it was growing up to be the magic city. It was one of the fastest growing cities in Louisiana around 1912 because of the exploding lumber mill. And so Snoozer was a musician. He was, as you can tell, born in 1907, playing in the very earliest days of jazz, where he was kind of absorbing all the influences of that country blues environment, Southern Mississippi. And then because Bogalusa was such a hot place, you had a lot of New Orleans musicians going to the North Shore to play music as well. He was hearing all of these amazing sounds in this very, very busy place and evolved a very unique style of playing jazz guitar. And the very, very quick snapshot is that Snoozer Quinn is considered one of the early jazz guitar pioneers. And among those, you'd rank him with Eddie Lang and Lonnie Johnson. He had a very unique style because he did not play with a pick or a plectrum. He used his fingers. And that allowed him to play multiple parts at the same time. He could play bass, rhythm, and pile a melody on top of it, and was a virtuoso. That's the quick nutshell of who he is. But he had a tragic life because he basically touched fame, had many, many opportunities to record for Victor and Columbia, played with Paul Whiteman, hobnobbed with the top names in jazz, but his own recordings never saw the light of day. We have records of the times he recorded with Victor and Columbia, records of the shows he performed with Paul Whiteman. Alas, they were never released. So everything we heard about him and know about him was mythological almost. It was like rumor mongering, passed around. His name was passed around among musicians of that era. And even Bing Crosby would send his people out to go hear Snoozer. He's like, you got to hear this guy from Bogalusa. What ended up happening is that Snoozer was dying in a tuberculosis ward in Charity Hospital in New Orleans. It was about 1948, and he was there for a full 9 months. And New Orleans cornet player and teacher Johnny Wiggs went to the hospital with a recording machine and recorded Snoozer pretty much on his deathbed and got the sound of Snoozer Quinn captured for posterity in the style for which he's known, that early jazz finger style. So thanks to Johnny Wiggs, we have some glimpse of Snoozer's amazing abilities.
So I'm curious, after Johnny Wiggs recorded Snoozer, where did these recordings live? That you said they weren't sold commercially. Were they kept in an archive, or how was that preserved?
Oh, actually, they did eventually get recorded, released. They got released first. Johnny Wiggs released them on his own label, as 78s, four of the sides. He released four of them as 78s. And then he gave the whole kit and caboodle to a label called Fat Cat out of Manassas, Virginia. And they released them on a 30 LP. So they did exist. And you could find them if you knew to look for them. And then fast forward to 2014, my friend here in New Orleans, Tom Stagg, who runs the 504 label, he put them together and put them out as MP3. So you can actually now listen to Snoozer Quinn play on Spotify and YouTube and all the other places. So we are going to get his music out there. That's all we want to do. We want people to know about Snoozer. So this new book has finally come along and I'm super excited about it.
So obviously you have a family connection. Is that how you were initially knowledgeable about his music?
Yes, but what's funny is I didn't even know he played guitar. My family talked about him for his violin playing and his kind of trickster abilities. You know, they would, apparently he could do it all. He could play violin. In fact, his earliest nickname was Fiddler, and that's how he was known at Bogalusa High School and at his church at the Bogalusa Baptist, Superior Avenue Baptist Church, because he was, you know, just the bee's knees. He played for all the high school events and all the church events. And he also had all these trick abilities on banjo, and he could do things like play the guitar behind his head, and he could play guitar with one hand and still make amazing sounds come out of it. I want to come back to that, by the way, because that's how he ultimately got his gig with Paul Whiteman. But yeah, my family, they just talked about him, and I thought he had a funny name, and I just heard he was like really, really cool, could do all these cool tricks. But I was talking to my friend up in Shreveport. I was in a jazz trio, and this is around 2001, 2002. And I was in a jazz trio called Howell and Caskey, and my friend Steve Howell, a guitar player who now lives in Marshall, Texas, we would always trade stories about, they were always trying to educate me. And so I decided I'd educate them, and I told them about my uncle with a funny name, Snoozer Quinn. Much to my surprise, Steve knew about him already, and he's basically schooled me, and he said he's an incredible guitar player, and he's like an important part of early jazz guitar history. Steve knows like a lot about a lot of music. So I thought that was pretty impressive. But what really blew my mind is a couple of weeks later, he gifts me a photograph that he's blown up of Snoozer Quinn and Louis Armstrong standing together that was hanging on the wall at the Shreveport Musicians Union. That's where the original copy lives. And I'm certainly not I wasn't a Shreveport Musician Union member. I didn't even know about this. My mind just blew. I was like, who, what? Like nobody in my family ever talked about this aspect of him, that he was a friend of Louis Armstrong's. And I was at that time, like early, early into my worship days of early jazz musicians from New Orleans. So my mind was blown. And that's basically, I was like, okay, I've got to find out everything I can about Snoozer Quinn. A couple of years later, I moved to New Orleans. I started going to graduate school at Tulane, and here in New Orleans, all the people who know about early jazz and New Orleans jazz knew about Snoozer. So you're talking about the warm, embracing community of, you know, like Bruce Rayburn and Lynn Abbott and people like John Rankin, and just different people at the like Carolyn Kolb, Peggy Scott Laborde. They all like were like, this is a great topic. You should pursue it. You should research this. And so I did. And I dove into the jazz archives at Tulane. I dove into the archives all over the city, the Louisiana State Museum. I started meeting my family in Bogalusa and gathering as many stories as I could. I started tracing musicians who might still be alive, who might possibly have met Snoozer. Only found a couple, but I did get interviews with those people. I went into nursing homes in Bogalusa and around the Covington area. I just did everything I could do to try to find anyone who had a memory of Snoozer. And I got those, and I started working on that, like I said, in 2004. Took a long time, but I finally finished my master's thesis in 2013. And now almost 20 years later, I've got a book.
So your master's thesis was also based on Snoozer?
Yes.
So I should ask just quickly here, how did he get the nickname Snoozer?
Snoozer had one eye and had a misshapen head. And he liked to sit in the back and kind of in the shadows and keep himself hidden. and he looked like he was asleep when he was playing. And the person who gave him the nickname Snoozer was Peck Kelly, another obscure but worshipped figure from Texas, piano player. He was in a band with Peck Kelly around the 1924 to 1926 era. And Peck Kelly gave him that name because he was so good he could play asleep. And also he looked like he was sleeping.
Wow, that's very fascinating. Obviously you said you scoured all the archives, you went and did first person interviews. What is it about him, and you play the guitar yourself, what is it about his guitar playing that you think really sets him apart and distinguishes him?
Let me just first add the caveat that I co-wrote this book with Dan Sumner, who's a guitar player, a jazz guitar player, who's legit. I am not legit. I like to play three chord songs. I can feel the emotional wallop of the music. I can feel the sensibility shining through. I'm not the person who can discuss the technical aspects as well as others. In fact, I've had incredibly generous assistance all along the way from guitar players like John Rankin, Chip Henderson, Dan Sumner, who helped me explicate the music. Dan Sumner actually transposed those hospital recordings for this book. So the book comes with sheet music as well as tablature for real legit musicians to get into the music. My 10 cent explanation of what Snoozer's doing, because he's playing with his fingers and because he has developed techniques from years on the big tent show circuit, Chautauqua circuit around the southern parts of the United States, he needed to develop an arsenal of tricks to impress the audiences. So he would play his guitar with his left hand on the neck, as we all do, making chord shapes and things. But he also was a very, very early adopter of using his right hand to, in not just strumming it, but picking, and also using it to hammer on the strings like a banjo player might. And in fact, there's a really, really appealing quote from Les Paul, who said that Snoozer was the one who taught him to hammer and pull on the neck of a guitar in order to make sounds with your right hand. So all of these tricks he developed allowed him to play multiple parts at the same time. He also had slack tuning, like he drop tuned his guitar and had different chord voicings so that he was able to reach different areas of the guitar and make more sounds than we're normally accustomed to the way we tune it in standard. And also by slack tuning it, the strings were a little wobblier and had faster action. So that's kind of my explanation of how he did what he did. When you listen to the hospital recordings and you try to follow along with his music, it might frustrate you unless you realize that he was drop tuning. And Dan does an amazing job in the book of presenting how to play along with the book. You know, he has like how to use this book, how to play these songs. It's a really, really great breakdown.
So something you really have to read between the lines to find out, not necessarily immediately visible in the sheet music itself. You mentioned Les Paul. How did he come into contact with Snoozer Quinn?
So he was still pretty young. Snoozer had played, like I said, in a band with Paul Wyman, had gone up to New York City and recorded. We're talking about 1928. The way that Snoozer met Paul Wyman was, it was here at the St. Charles Theater in New Orleans when Paul Wyman had a show. It was like a matinee performance and an evening performance. And there was a jam session in between, and some of the guys heard Snoozer playing. All the New Orleans cats were like, we got to get Snoozer up and hear the and meet these guys. So some of Paul Whiteman's people, Frankie Chumbauer and Vic Spiderbeck, they heard Snoozer playing and they were like, we got to get you in front of Paul Whiteman. So Snoozer did his famous trick, which was, this all happened backstage at the St. Charles Theater, where he went up to Paul Whiteman and said, nice to meet you, Mr. Whiteman, and started playing the Tiger Rag. And while he was playing the Tiger Rag, playing bass, rhythm, and melody all at the same time, he stuck out his hand to shake Paul Whiteman's hand without missing a note. And the music never stopped. And apparently it was so astounding that Paul Whiteman started beating his head and shoulders against the brick wall of the theater. It was like, oh man, you got to come with me. You're hired. And so just a couple weeks later, Snoozer got on a train and went to New York City to meet the orchestra. And I have like just like really cool detailed newspaper records of all this happening, as well as the amazing oral histories from the musicians themselves at the Hogan Jazz Archives. So then Bing Crosby, of course, was a contemporary and a favorite person for Paul Whiteman to have with his little mini orchestras. And Bing Crosby would oftentimes lead like a smaller subset of the orchestra on his vocal albums. And Eddie Lang was the guitarist who most frequently played with Bing Crosby, but Les Paul told him he should check out Snoozer Quinn. But by then Snoozer was out of there. The big time, the big city, everything going on with Paul Whiteman, that was not for him. It was not his scene. He went back home to Bogalusa. So when Les Paul, sometime in the mid-40s, was down in New Orleans, he sought him out and he drove to Bogalusa and sat on the front porch with him and played guitar with him for a whole afternoon and said, Snoozer Quinn is the one who taught me to hammer and pull strings. And I read that in a guitar player magazine that I pulled from 1987, an interviewer named Jazz Obrecht. I was like, well, I need more information. So I contacted Les Paul and I got to go meet him in 2008 and I got backstage and he spent some time with me and he was so nice and so sweet. And I put this little clip up on YouTube of me and Les Paul. And then recently, thank goodness, I found like the full audio of my interview with Les Paul. So I was like, I have to transcribe that again. And yeah, but it was great. Like Snoozer has opened all these doors for me because he's truly a musician's musician. People who know.
That's amazing. I mean, obviously, this sounds like a project that you were meant to pursue. We're going to take a brief break, a pause for the cause here at WHIV 102.3. And when we come back, we're going to hear some of Snoozer's original recordings, and we'll be able to really get a sense of what made him so remarkable. We'll be right back.